Welcome to Hope Talks, where we share inspiring stories of hope in Jesus Christ. Hope Talks is hosted by Pastor Margaret Michael and Grayson Willis. Join us for uplifting stories of triumph, faith, and the enduring power of Christ's love. Also, if you're in the listening area, tune in to 1470 AM or 102.1 FM WBTX to listen to Hope Talks every Sunday at noon.
Welcome to today's broadcast of Hope Talks. I'm Grayson Willis.
I'm Pastor Margaret Michael. It's so good to be here again today. And today, I'm always excited about who we have on the podcast.
We always have good guests.
That's right. We always have good guests. And today is no different. So today, Dwayne Martin is here with us from Harmon Construction on behalf of Harmon Construction and Isaiah House. Would that be correct?
That is correct.
Yes, you are the project manager on the Isaiah House build. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. We met during groundbreaking, right? We were walking through the dust and putting some chairs and tables away, and here we are.
The dust and heat.
Yes, it was a warm day that day. So we love to start this podcast out talking a little bit about where you're from and how you grew up. We want to get to Isaiah House and everything that's happening there. We want to give our listeners the opportunity for an update, and just, I think you all will be as excited as we are around the table by the time it's over. But we want to start a little bit, just getting a little background about you. So, yeah, where are you from? How'd you grow up?
I grew up in a little town in Pennsylvania called Terry Hill. It is central Lancaster County, the garden spot of the state. I went to Garden Spot High School and lived there with my parents, obviously, a family of 14. There were five biological children. The rest are adopted. And I say that, I always tease my siblings and say, Mom and Dad had five kids and they went till they got it right. I was number five, and then they adopted the rest. My adopted siblings
hate that
joke. But I grew up in what we considered a plain Mennonite family. Mm-hmm. We attended Red Run Mennonite Church until I was about 13 years old. And then my parents moved us all to New Life Fellowship in Ephrata, Pennsylvania.
Wow.
And so it took us out of the plain Mennonite church and into what we considered a worldly church. They had a guitar.
Wow.
It's my first introduction. Like they played a guitar at this church. So I was hooked at that point.
Yeah.
But big family. My parents were born and raised in Lancaster County in Terry Hill, and where my mom was right outside in Hawnstown. But I knew all of my third, fourth cousins because the whole family stayed there, and I was one of the very first boys within five generations to ever leave the area.
Wow.
So my mom spent a lot of phone conversations with me asking when I'm coming back.
I'm sure.
So what was it like growing up in a big, I consider that a big family, the youngest of five plus adopted siblings and a lot of cousins and other family living close by?
It made a very interesting childhood. I always say I'm a psychologist's dream because I came from a family where I was the youngest of five and the oldest of nine. So my parents actually had a group home for foster children. They were foster parents long before I was born. And when I was very young, I was probably maybe seven or eight when they adopted the first set of siblings, two girls and a boy, Jennifer, Bobby, and John. But growing up in that family, it was it created experiences that I didn't learn to appreciate until I was a whole lot older. As a child growing up in it, it seemed chaotic at times. Because in addition to the children that they adopted, there was always children coming and going constantly. The home was designated as a group home when I was 14. And so we'd have children that came for 24 hours, some that came for a couple years. Some that were literally there just for hours while they're waiting for permanent placement in foster care.
Yeah, they were kind of waiting. That's what Isaiah House is for, right? That's
right.
Really cool.
It really rang true.
Yeah, that's amazing. And why you're at the table today. I think that's so fascinating. So did you grow up and go, man, I want to get married and I want to have the same experience?
I was the opposite of all my siblings. Being number five and then the oldest of nine, I was what my parents called a troubled youth. Looking back in retrospect, I think it was a pretty mild sense of troubled youth. But I went through a pretty serious, in their words, rebellion time as a teenager when I was in that journey to figure out who I am and where I fit in the family constellation. It was, I look back now again with hindsight and seeing that family constellation, that was very challenging for a young man growing up with that amount of people coming through and my parents' time and attention really being demanded by so many. But I came into my young adult years or late teen years not following the Mennonite path. I had a lot of interest in the military, which was very counter of everything we were taught growing up. And my parents were none so pleased with that, with that that direction I wanted to go in my life. My dad actually made me a deal. My dad and my grandfather, when the Desert Storm, the first war, had broken out, and a lot of my friends, several of them, had joined the military right out of high school, and I wanted to do the same path. I had looked into Marine Corps. I met with a recruiter. My parents found out. I met with the recruiters. Funny side note, I told the recruiter, my parents are Mennonites, so please don't come to the house. And the recruiter did not know what a Mennonite was. So guess who showed up at supper time? The United States Marine. So my parents found out.
Sorry, I'm laughing.
Oh, no. That day it was tense.
He should have said, "What's a Mennonite?" And then you could have told
explained
him.
It. Yeah. But in my naivety at that stage in life, I thought everybody knew what a Mennonite was. It was the only world I ever knew.
Right.
So long story short, and my dad and grandfather talked to me, and my dad made me a deal. He said, if you do a year of missionary work out of high school, he said, if you still want to do that, I'll personally drive you to the recruiting station.
Wow.
So that was very wise of my dad, and they won. I went into missionary service, and I met this beautiful young lady in the training, and immediately knew that she didn't know yet, but she was going to be my wife, and next month it'll be 30 years that we've been married. So needless to say,
congratulations.
The military never came to fruition. Thank you.
Yeah, I have a friend that just at 50 went through basic training and became a chaplain.
Oh, wow.
So it's not too late.
Right. Let's say my ambitions have changed. My little girl and son-in-law just got out of the military a year ago.
Yeah.
And my ambitions have changed.
Yeah.
I'm just waiting to be grandpa now.
That's right. I can't beat that.
So any stories from your childhood growing up in Lancaster in the Mennonite community and a big family that you would like to share with us? And how did you end up in Rockingham County from Lancaster, Pennsylvania?
That pretty girl. I actually went to New York City after the training in Salonga, Pennsylvania. I went through Eastern Mennonite Board of Missions. And they sent me to the Bronx, New York. And they took a rural Lancaster County kid and dropped me on 167th Street and Sherman Avenue in the Bronx. And this was on the tail end of the crack epidemic. So I was a fish out of water.
Culture shock.
Yes. But the big hook that got me to go there, I wish I could tell you some big spiritual awakening that took me to New York City, but the reality of it was I had season tickets to the Yankees, and we lived three blocks from the stadium. But that was also the year that the Yankees went on strike. So I was in the stadium when
94.
Yep. And that was the year that they were throwing quarters and dollar bills out onto the playing field from the stands when the Yankees were doing some practice. But so I never got to see a Yankees game when I was there. But going back into the childhood, if you're looking at those formative years and things that you can look back on now and say, these are where transformations of the life kind of got set into motion. My parents being foster parents and having the large volume of kids coming through really set me up for a unique life opportunity. And, a lot of that stuff, I would have never said this when I was 17, 18, 19 years old. But with some life experience, I started looking back like, wow, I can start pinpointing where things started to happen. And one of the very remarkable things, when I was just a little boy, there was a foster boy that came, and his name was Jason Huff. And we were about the same age. So I instantly had a brother my age. My only other brother at the time was several years older than me. So Jason and I, we were brothers, and we were, best of my recollection, we were pretty close and played like brothers do. My parents wanted to adopt Jason. And, the parents, his biological mother was still working on getting him returned. And it wasn't going well. There were several visits that I remember. Some of my memories now are because I asked my mom about it and she refreshes my memory. But the mother really wanted Jason to come home, but the boyfriend did not want him to come home. So my parents back in the day, when you did parental visits and stuff, my parents were in charge of those parental visits. It wasn't always a social worker. Yeah, when I was 16, I actually did parental visits. I drove to Lancaster City and was the chaperone for parental visits. But that's another story. But one day, my mom and my dad told me and my other siblings that Jason was going to be going back home. And we were all like, we were kind of used to it. Like, kids would come and go, but Jason was special. And I think to me more so because he was my age, but that he was going to be going back home for a trial run with the mom so she could regain custody of him. But the word from my mom was at the time they knew that the boyfriend did not want Jason to return. So long story short, I remember clearly, I know this memory is my own, standing on the front porch of our house and seeing Jason pressed up against the back glass of the social worker's vehicle as she drove him away. It was about several weeks, let's say 3 weeks later. My parents always went to a local coffee shop every morning for coffee. They had friends, the Pattersons, that they had coffee with every morning. And I remember my parents coming home, my mom, just in tears, because Jason had been murdered by the boyfriend. And, back in the day, things were different in social work. It's an emotional topic. I usually don't cover that one too much. I mean, that was a long time ago. I'm 50 years old. That was quite a few years. But I remember my mom coming home in tears because there's a little boy that they wanted.
That was was personal.
Yeah, it was very personal. They wanted him. They wanted to keep him. They wanted to raise him. He was part of the family. And so our family never got to participate in any type of memorial service or anything like that. But that was a transformational spot in my life. And I was too young to really put that together at the time of what this meant. I don't even think I fully grasped what death meant, only that I knew that he wasn't coming back to our house. You know, fast forward a couple years in seventh grade, I talked about that story. My mom was very open. My parents, both of them, were very open about that story. And it was also a lot of the reason that solidified their ministry in foster care was that moment with Jason. And I took all the memories that I had, and one of them being a mark in my parents' house that stayed for decades, that Jason had pulled the drawers out of one of the chest of drawers that was in the living room, and he had climbed all the way up and drew at the top of the wall in the ceiling with a crayon. And as my parents did some remodeling and painting, I remember my mom not painting over that spot. Mm-hmm. You know, that stayed for a long time. But in seventh grade, I was not a good student. You know, still, I was that kid, always into mischief, always getting a little bit of trouble here and there. But I had a teacher that said, you have some writing ability. And she was pushing me in writing. And she got me started to read some books and started to have me writing. And she said, what's the biggest story with the biggest impact you could write? And at that stage in my life, Jason was my story. So I wrote that story. And it ended up winning an award with the Lancaster New Era newspaper. I got taken into Lancaster City on a Sunday afternoon where they bought for $100. They bought the story from me. And then they put it into the archives of the Lancaster New Era paper in City of Lancaster. Wow. And I'm actually, since we started with the Isaiah House, I've been reaching out trying to find that story. And so far, I've been unsuccessful with it. Mm. But, you know, growing up and having some type of formidable moment saying, this is one of the spots I can look back to that really drove my life, it would be that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I cannot imagine how hard that must have been for your mother and for you and for everyone.
The whole family.
I know that at one point in my life, I was looking at social work and someone was just trying to give me a realistic view of what that would be like. And they're like, there's times that you want to make things better and you can't.
Yeah.
And that's one of those times.
Yep.
It's the chance that you take. Praise God that Jesus never turned his face from that little boy.
Right.
Yeah. Right. But yeah, thank you for sharing that. That's close and deep. But it really does, as you're sharing with us, like, I know that you wanted to go far from foster care and all of that, but here we are at the table. So let's move on with the story to the next chapter.
The next chapter, we'll fast forward a couple years from seventh grade on. You know, to set the stage for how this developed when I was 16 years old, that's like the moment you start saying, who am I? What am I going to do? You start to figure things out. And as a teenager, that can go 10 different ways in a 7-day period. But I decided I wanted to follow my grandfather's path and be a butcher. You know, that's what my grandfather did. And I loved that. And I actually worked at Shady Maple, of all places.
I've been there.
Oh, yeah, that's a staple of Lancaster County. Yep. I went there. I learned meat cutting. I worked in my grandfather's, or it was owned by my dad's cousin at the time, but New Holland Meat Markets. So I went to work there. And, you know, in all my wisdom at 16 years old and talking with my dad, I thought, well, why am I in school? You know, all I do is get in trouble and spend my evenings in detention hall. I might as well work. And so my dad agreed, and he took me and signed me out of high school. So I quit, which in the community we grew up in, that was not a rebellious nature whatsoever. A lot of young men in that community drop out at 16 in the ninth grade. But I dropped out of high school, went to work in the family business, and I was working at some at Shady Maple, some at Yoder's, and then mainly at New Holland Meat Markets and the Green Dragon. If you're from Pennsylvania, everyone knows that one. Mm-hmm. And I went to work one morning and I said, this is not the life I want. It just, and I couldn't articulate why or what it was, but I just knew that this is not the path I want to be on. So I ended up talking to a gentleman that worked at a butcher shop and turned out just to be a train wreck of a conversation. And so it really forced me into my own, saying, who am I and who do I want to be? And long story short, there was a teacher at Garden Spot High School, Stan Dean. Everyone knew him affectionately as Mr. Dean. There was just a movie released last year about his life called Brave the Dark. But he was a teacher that was just beyond special to thousands of students. So I was one of many. But I went to the school and I said, Mr. Dean, what would I have to do to get back in school? And he's like, well, come on in. And he had actually stopped at my parents' church one night and talked to me, and not about coming back to school, just about what I wanted out of life. And that sparked that thought process that one morning at the butcher shop. So he ended up taking me into the principal's office, which I was very familiar with at 16 years old, and said, Dwayne would like to come back to school. And the principal at the time told me he wasn't interested in having me back. And he said, and I quote, the world needs broom pushers too. And you know, we could be angry about that, but looking back, he had every right to have that opinion. But Mr. Dean talked to me quite a while and talked to the teacher and then talked to my parents. And I'd missed a year of school, the better part of a year. And I missed the rest of the year because I ended up being in a really bad car accident that Christmas. But Mr. Dean actually met with me, had me really think about who I am and what I wanted to be. and which at the time was very counter to what my parents are. I didn't want to go to church, and I did, but I didn't want to. It was, I lived at home, so I had to go. You know, so I was trying to figure out who I am. Mr. Dean said, if you come to school every day early, I'll help you make up all the classes that you missed. You can still graduate with your class. We can get you back on the track you were on. And that man, along with hundreds of other students, treated me like I was the only one and helped me make up all of my classes, got me involved in Garden Spot Performing Arts, where I was in the play The Outsiders in my senior year. I had a lead role in that play, which was a big deal growing up. Still fun to look back on. But it started really getting me thinking, who am I and what do I want to do? But I kept going back home to this chaotic home life where, and I say chaotic, I mean that as respectfully as I can to my parents. Remember, we're looking through the lens of a 16, 17-year-old. And the kids would come, the kids would go, and I'd tell my parents, I'm never going to do this. As soon as I can fly this coop, I'm out of here. You know, and I did. At 17, almost 18 years old, I moved out on my own to finish out my senior year of high school, or 18 rather. But I kept telling my parents, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing this. And I remember my mom saying, well, if that's true, why do you come home every time a new child comes? Well, that's not fair. You know,
whoa.
It was accurate, but there was something that just drew me back to every time a new child would come. And mainly they had a lot of young boys, and I would go back and we had the same routine. We'd go fishing. We would go to the Black Creek and we would catch bluegills. And I, you know, again, like many other things, I couldn't articulate why it kept drawing me back there, but a new child would come, whether it was 24 hours or a week or a couple years. Mom was right. I would go back. So fast forward again, I graduated high school and I moved into New York City. And when I was in New York City, my mom said, she said, I wish you wouldn't have went to New York City. The other option was Immokalee, Florida. But I was adventurous and New York City was on the table and they needed people. So I went there and I got introduced to a life that I'd never seen any element of before, ever. I lived on 167th and Sherman Avenue right in the Bronx. It was a crack epidemic. I'd never seen homeless people of that nature. I'd never seen people strung out on drugs. I never lived in a culture that everybody looked different to me. I think I was the only white person on that street. You know, even my roommate was a guy from Zimbabwe. And I was lost at that first point in my life where I started thinking like, hey, you're getting this down. You're figuring it out. You're getting stuff back together. Well, reset, back to the bottom of the ladder. You know, who am I? Why am I here? And my time in New York City was, it was interesting. I met so many young people through the church I worked with, and I was actually a youth leader in the church. And, you know, looking back, I kind of laugh at that now, like, man, you took this kid and made him a youth leader, you know, at that tender age of 18. Mm-hmm. But I became a youth leader in church, and we started going around the city and meeting homeless kids. And, you know, I had no idea what I was supposed to do when I met them, but we went out and met them, and I was a kid myself. But I remember one night I met this one young man that just really, really pulled my heartstrings. So I took him home and I found out from my house parents, Michael and Addie Banks, that I was not allowed to do that. Welcome to New York City. We don't bring strangers into the house. Mm-hmm. You know, so they, you know, being the incredible people they were born and raised in New York City. Michael Banks was quite the circuit speaker in the Mennonite churches at that time. They used it as a very powerful training, teaching moment for me, where we got this young guy into a home where he could get the help he needed. Yeah. And then he promptly disappeared. Never saw him again. You know, and honestly, I don't even remember his name at this point. But it was like, man, you know, in my mind at the time, it was like we just gave him everything he was telling me he needed, and he just disappeared. So again, you're like, wow, like how does this thing work? I go back to the pretty wise words of my mom. You know, she's like, keep trying. Mm-hmm. It didn't work, but keep trying. And my dad's like, well, he said, you just got to go out and find someone else. You know, mm-hmm. They were very interesting in how they, and back then I'd write letters to my parents. There was no email. There was no Facebook.
Right.
And we weren't paid, so we couldn't afford long distance phone calls. So we wrote letters back and forth, but just keep going. So I ended up spending the better part of a year in New York City and I met some great kids. I was actually on a subway train coming out of the village one Saturday night and I met a good friend up there named Terrell. And I was sitting in the middle seat between Terrell and another guy, and Terrell kept elbowing me. And he's like, you know who that is? You know who that is? And I looked at the guy immediately to my right, but I'm literally rubbing elbows with, and I was like, I don't know who that is. He's like, that's Will Smith. And I was like, looked right at Will Smith, and I was like, who's Will Smith? Then he said, the Fresh Prince. Then I was like, oh, I get it. And he said, hi, and that was the end of our interaction. You know, I guess that was before he was very, very famous. He was still riding the train coming out of the village.
Wow.
But my time in New York City ended up being cut a bit short. I didn't stay for the full year that I'd signed up for. The church that I was assigned to ended up dissolving. It was in the North Bronx. It was North Bronx Mennonite Church, but it ended up dissolving. I really couldn't get the participation and the pastor at the time. He and his wife decided to move to Washington State. So after about 7 months of work at that church, they shut down, dissolved, and they moved me to Burnside Mennonite, where Michael was the pastor. And then it really wasn't much work for me to do in the city. I made things up to do for myself. I would travel around and meet people and chat with people and really found that I loved people. And I got introduced to this thing where I could hear people's stories, and you could meet people randomly on the street, and they would tell you their story. Probably half of them lied to me because they wanted money, but I was a missionary kid. I didn't have anything.
Yeah.
You know, but I started hearing these stories from people that just amazed me. I met a gentleman in a subway one time. He said, "Well, come down to where I live." And so we were in Manhattan, and right off 42nd Street, which we were forbidden to be on. But again, this teenager was like, "Oh, forbidden. I wonder why. Let's go check it out." And 42nd Street was also known as Porn Alley. I mean, it was just a very dangerous part of Manhattan at the time. But I met this gentleman, and he said, "Well, come on down, and I'll show you where I live." So me and my naive nature said, "Oh, yeah." So I went with him. And ended up being this tremendous guy. And he told me his story and how he wound up on the streets. And he was born and raised in New York City. Pretty much, he was quite a bit older than I was at the time. But there was no one to, either I was completely protected by the Holy Spirit, or this guy just wanted somebody to tell a story. So we sat for hours in the subway, where the back behind where the trains go. I just set myself up to get murdered is what happened. But I ended up meeting this incredible guy. Yeah. And we chatted, and his story just touched me. And again, you know, after I left, I went back to find him later. Never saw him again. And that is the nature of the homeless in New York City. But so I was telling my house parents about it, and they just shook their head. Because at this point, I had been mugged twice because I kept smiling at everybody, and everyone knew I was new to the area, so I'd been mugged twice. And Michael was like, "Dwayne, you have to start having some discretion." And I was like, "Gotcha, discretion, understood it." So the following weekend, there was a singer that was coming, Chuck Neufeld, if you remember that name, another singer from the 90s in the Mennonite community. He was from Kansas. He came to New York City and was doing some shows, and we didn't have a vehicle, but the church got a van and needed somebody to usher Chuck Neufeld around the city. So I was like, "I'll do it," because why not? You know, there's no Google Maps. Well, I ended up getting Chuck Neufeld really, really lost. I literally pulled over somewhere in Manhattan. I had no idea where I was at. And he got all his gear, his guitar, his amp, everything, very frustrated with me because I failed to say, "I have no idea where we're going." So he gets out of the van, gets on a train, and goes on his way. Now here I am in Manhattan, totally lost, no idea where I'm at, in this 15-passenger van, 18 years old, thinking, "Well, I'll figure it out." I don't go real far at all, and the van starts to overheat. I was like, "All right, what am I going to do? I'm not a mechanic, I'm a butcher." So I ended up pulling over, and I'm thinking, I can't keep driving. No cell phones of the day, and I couldn't see a payphone. I'm in Manhattan. Van keeps overheating, so I thought, "Well, I'll just keep driving a little bit and see what happens." Well, it pegged out and got really hot and started smoking, so I pulled over. And this homeless guy comes up, and he, like, knocks on the window. He said, "You're overheating." Clearly, thank you for that. I can see that. And he said, "I can fix it." And I began being kind of naive. Okay, I believe you. What do we got to do? He said, "Well, it's going to cost you $40. All right. I had our house debit card in my pocket because I was in charge of the finances for the little house we lived in at the time. So I was like, "Well, I don't have $40, but I can go to an ATM, stranger, get in." So this guy gets in the van, and he dressed like a homeless guy, smelled like a homeless guy, didn't have tools. We had a wrench in the back of the van that we found. And we drove to an ATM, pulled over, and he stood beside me at the ATM. I put in our passcode, and I got $40 out. And I paid him, and he fixed the van. And then I drove him back to where I picked him up because he lived there in Central Park in the woods. And he gave me directions on how to get back to the Bronx. Now, the whole time I'm like, that was cool. You know, and he had a neat story, too. He was telling me he lived on the streets. He was a drug addict. He was very open about that. He was a crack addict. And I went back home and I was like, Michael, you got to hear this story. I met this cool guy. And he just said, "Dwayne, you're going to get murdered." So I learned a lot, you know, there of skating by the skin of my teeth on a lot of ways. But also opening some doors and meeting some amazing people that I never would have met otherwise.
Yeah.
Now, anybody listening to this, if you have a young son or daughter going to New York City, let's
don't do this.
Not do that.
These are things not to do.
Yeah. Put this in the list of not to do.
The Lord protected you during all these.
I think that might be why he has gray hairs in the pictures. You know, those angels were busy. You know,
they're like, "Oh no.
Here he goes again."
They felt like that with me too, I think.
Yeah.
So from there, well, when you were in New York, is that where you met your wife?
So I actually met her in the training in Salonga, Pennsylvania. We were there for 1 month before the training, and we got to know each other actually in a maple tree of all things. We were both a little overwhelmed with the crowd, so I climbed up a maple tree and man, good things do grow in trees, because I was like, there's a pretty girl in this tree. So, and her name is Denise. We met there in the tree and got chatting. And a month later, I told her, I was like, we're going to get married.
Yeah.
But she went to Aflex, Kentucky for her term, and I went to New York City. So it was a lot of letter writing back and forth. And she told me later, one of the biggest things she learned about me quickly was I couldn't spell. She still married me, but I couldn't spell.
Well, you know, we can't have it all, right?
That's right. That's right.
We can't. That's what she was for. Fix that. So you met her. Now, do you all have children?
We do. We have two biological children. We have Gavin. He's 28 years old, lives here local. He's a graduate of Virginia Tech, and he goes all over the country planting trees for a conservation company. Mm. A very successful young man. He's married to a very lovely wife, Mandy. And they got married a year ago in the Virgin Islands. That was a fun wedding. And then we have Kaylin, our daughter. She is 6 years younger than Gavin. And she and her husband just got out of the United States Army. They served in Germany for 4 years. My daughter was there for four. My son-in-law was there 5 years. Kaylin was a 68 Whiskey, which in military ease, that is a combat medic. Mm. So my little girl, she has a spirit of her dad. She's like, oh, it could be dangerous. Let's give it a try. You know, our son is, Gavin is very much like his mom, very academically gifted, just a phenomenal outdoor biologist that just is great at what he does. Mm. And then our son-in-law, Cameron, that's married to Kaylin, he obviously came back with Kaylin. They live next door to Denise and I. And he works for Harmon Construction.
Okay.
So he jumped right into the construction world and a fine young man. So we are very proud of our kids and our son and daughter-in-law.
So when did the tide begin to shift and you begin to think about foster kids?
So my wife and I were not married long at all. We were very young. Actually, we were so young that the first foster care agency we talked to said, you're too young. And we were. But they still brought us in. We ended up working with Children's Services of Virginia for several years. But my wife came to me and she said, let's be foster parents. She would be very interested in being foster parents. And I was, no, no interest. You know, I had all these great events in life and seeing my parents that they were still operating the group home at the time and kids coming and going. And I won't say I had zero interest, but I had so many reservations about doing it. I had at the time, I had maybe ill-placed animosity towards my parents, but it was not a good subject for me. I did not want that chaotic life for our children. And the time we were pregnant with Gavin, our first, and I just didn't want that life for him. For me, I would go back to more negative things as a result of living in my parents' group home. Mm-hmm. All my biological siblings, for the most part, have been gone and on their way, except my sister Diane. She was home much longer, but we were all pretty much there for it. But it wasn't a good experience. At the time, I look at it and say it was not necessarily a good experience. So my wife brought it up. I just didn't really want to. And I didn't protest that bad with her. I just simply did not want to. So the very first appointment she had made to talk to Children's Services of Virginia, she actually went to the first training by herself. And not because I was like, I ain't going, I'm staying home, you do it on your own. I wasn't going to prioritize it. So she went to the first meeting on her own and came home. And she's like, you know, there's really something I would like to do. And the gentleman who owned Children's Services of Virginia, it's a private foster care program, and his name was Sam Sabah. And he come out and talked to us because of our age, not because I was protesting, because of our ages. And he asked me about my background. And the more I started talking to him, I was like, I kind of want to do this, but I don't, you know.
Yeah.
but I kind of do. You know, so long story short, we ended up going through the training together, my wife and I, and we became foster parents. But we both had a very solid agreement with this, that if it started negatively affecting our children, we would pull the plug. Mm. And because I did not want the experiences I had, or I thought I didn't want the experiences I had to be experiences my children had. And I turned out to be unequivocally wrong on that. My children have a lot of the same experiences. So I did tell my wife, I was like, look, no little children. I can't emotionally handle having babies or one-year-olds. Mm-hmm. I can't do it. Because my parents had several that when they would come in, like my mom said, you're the first one to come back and hold them. And I did, and I loved them. But when they would leave as a teenager, I wasn't going to sit in a corner and cry or necessarily even talk to my parents about it. It came out of me as just anger, you know, and I couldn't articulate why, except for they were here and now they're gone. They're in a safe environment. Now they're not, you know, and earlier I'd spoke about having the opportunity to go along to some visits and see where the children were living in Lancaster City for the most part, seeing the parents and just like, why would we send them back to that? You know, I did not understand the restitution. I didn't understand the changes. A lot of things I didn't understand. Right. So my wife and I agreed that we wouldn't take any young children. So we ended up getting teenagers, you know, oh, we maybe should have stuck with the little kids.
Thank you for listening to today's broadcast of Hope Talks. We pray that part one of Dwayne Martin's testimony was a half hour of hope for your life. We also hope you'll join us next Sunday for part two of Dwayne's testimony right here at noon on 1470 AM and 102.1 FM WBTX. May God bless.
Hope Talks is sponsored by Church of the Nazarene in Harrisonburg in partnership with Sunshine Ministries. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe, rate, and leave a review on Spotify or Apple Podcast. Your feedback helps us spread hope to even more listeners. Stay tuned for more uplifting stories in the next episode. Until then, keep the faith, share the love, and find joy in the hope that Jesus Christ brings.